Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
欢迎收听艺术有毒，我是 Sammy。 从这期开始，我们除了会邀请嘉宾来聊艺术类的书籍以外，也会增加一些和作者的采访。那么这一期想要聊的这本书叫做 The Rise and Rise of the Private Museum， 翻译成中文可能是崛起再崛起的私人美术馆。这是英国 Lawn Humphrey 出版社和苏富比艺术学院合作的系列丛书 Hot Topics in the Art World 中间的第一本。这个系列丛书都是在介绍当今艺术世界中讨论最火热的一些话题，每本书的篇幅都比较短，写作和发行的周期也相对紧凑。除了这本关于私人美术馆的书正在出版的，还有关于归还文物、艺术博览会的神话等等这种话题。那么我们今天要聊的这本书的作者 Georgina Adam， 中文应该叫做乔治纳亚当，她是一位记者，也是 FT 金融时报的专栏作家和这个英国艺术新闻的特约编辑。在这本书之前，他其实也撰写了关于全球艺术市场的两本书，其中一本是2018年出版的，2019年出版中也出版了中文的，叫做 Dark Side of the Boom， 前爆后的暗处。这本书也在我们艺术有毒2019年4月的节目中专门聊过，我们也会在之后的 show notes 里放上收听链接。那么今天要聊的这本书因为篇幅不大，大概两三个小时就可以完全读完，内容非常非常的后世，里面提到了一份关于私人博物馆的调查报告，里说过现在艺术世界里有 70% 的私人博物馆都是在2000年之后才成立的，而五分之一的馆其实都是在最近五年才建立的，而只有两家博物馆是在1960年代之前成立的。其实听到这些数字，我觉得还是挺令人瞠目结舌的。至于为什么大部分的这个私人博物馆都是集中在收藏当代艺术，作者也给出的理由非常简单，就是市面上可以交易的这些古代艺术作品实在是很有限，而当代艺术一直都因为有充足的供应量，自然而然地成为了这个私人博物馆的收藏方向。那么这里说的私人博物馆还包括了公司和品牌性质的博物馆，尤其是两大奢侈品的集团 LVMH 和开云集团的美术馆，都是书里着重提到的重点。那么这两位最有钱最有势的皮诺和阿诺暗地里较劲比试，也好像成了艺术世界一个大家很喜欢的谈资。这本书除了讲创立私人博物馆背后的动机，还有这些有钱有闲的人的心理，也还提到了私人美术馆的未来。当美术馆的这个所有者去世之后，私人美术馆的使命和未来好像也变得很模糊。在这种很特殊的情况下，又生发出了一种私人美术馆和公立博物馆合作的新模式。虽然目前我们只看到了一些苗头，但也许会成为未来发展的一种可能性。好了，我觉得我可能对于这本书的剧透已经很多了，那接下来也来听一听我和作者 Georgina Adam 来聊这关于这本书的点点滴滴。
So thanks for being here.
Thank、
Georgina.
You for having me.
We are talking about your new book, The Rise and Rise of the Private Art Museum. Actually, your last book we actually talk about in our podcast as well, The Dark Side of the Boom. Yeah, and that one has been translated into Chinese.
Traditional Chinese.
Yes, traditional Chinese. Yes. It was published in Taiwan.
Correct.
That episode we have got huge feedback actually from the audiences.
Oh, really?
Yes, it was very welcome. Kind of maybe to begin with how you start with the idea of writing a book dedicated to private art museums.
Well, I've always been interested in the interaction between art and money. And of course, I'm a specialist of the art market. And my other great interest is the new phenomena of the 21st century.And my first two books were about the transformation and the excesses of the art market in the 21st century. And it's extraordinary because 70% of private museums were founded this century. So we're talking about, as well, what is happening with art and money, because money is relevant as well, because these are billionaires who were founding their own museums. And in the past, they probably didn't found their own museums. In the past, they probably had it at home, and then on their passing, they would give it to a local institution, a state institution often. So I was really interested in why, what are the motivations, and what has changed in the world that so many collectors want to keep their collection together and put it into their own art space.
Right. I just wonder, because you dedicated one chapter to the Private Museum in China.
Yes.
Maybe can you elaborate on why that?
Everybody always talks about the China Museum boom. And it's true. There's an extraordinary explosion of the creation of museums. To an extent, it's by the government. The government had a plan, because they see art as being a sort of soft power. It's a way of giving a good face to China, to the outside world. They also want to catch up with the West. So they want to have as many museums per head of population as countries that have got a more developed museum landscape. But for contemporary art, of course, they don't have the collections, they don't have the expertise. So I think that the Chinese authorities felt that a good way of achieving their aims would be to allow private collectors of art to create their own art spaces and to give them encouragements, whether that should be zoning operation, you know, zoning permission, reduced costs of hiring or taking the space. And so that was very much a motivation, I think, for the Chinese authorities. And in fact, in the book, I talk about three waves, you know, because obviously all of this is very recent compared to the West. But in the beginning, it was quite often private collectors who just needed somewhere to store their art, and they thought, well, let's put it in a public space. And they didn't have the sort of infrastructure that more established museums might have. And so some of those early museums actually died. They didn't survive. Then there was a second wave, and now we're talking about the third wave. What is interesting is the link with real estate, and of course at the moment China is in the eye of the storm with real estate projects that haven't necessarily succeeded. But very often a real estate developer will want to put a museum in the development because it might gain him some advantages in zoning laws again. Sadly, some of those museums don't really prosper because they've been put in really in order to bolster the real estate market.
Well, let me put it this way. The motivation of, you know, opening a private museum in China, what's the difference between, like, you know, the motivation of opening a private museum, let's say, in the States or
I think that to an extent some of the motivations are the same. Right. You have a collection. It's a way of boasting, of bragging. You're able to afford this art. And of course, there's a long Chinese tradition of collecting.
Yeah.
China has the oldest cultural history, I think, in the world. So to an extent, it's returning to an earlier collecting instinct. I think also in some cases, in many cases, it is connected with real estate. So it is something that is pushing the real estate project as well. And there's always the aspect of self-aggrandizement, thinking about what your legacy is going to be. And then there are more not such nice things, because if you put things into your private museum, perhaps you can enhance the value and then resell them later for a bigger price. So I think all of these motivations are actually quite similar in the West as well.
Yeah, and you actually mentioned that in the 20th century there are much more self-made wealth happening in the world. I believe in China that's especially true. Do you think that's also like a main contributor to?
Absolutely. I think that one of the very interesting aspects of the boom, the proliferation of private museums, is the fact that the sources of wealth have changed. Not only in China, but also in the West. Traditionally, if you go back 50 years, two generations back, wealth tended to be inherited. Now, it's a different context. Philanthropy was different as well. That's another aspect which is interesting. Today, an enormous amount of wealth is self-made. And when it's self-made wealth, you've got different motivations. For a start, you want to control things. Control is really important because you've built up your collection by yourself. You haven't inherited it. And you don't want to see it disappear when you pass. So I think that that is a very important aspect. And even the philanthropic aspect is different. Two generations ago, somebody would just write a check for their local institution. Mm-hmm. They don't want to do that anymore. They want to control what's happened. In fact, there's the notion of what's called philanthrocapitalism. And they come in and they want to be able to measure outcomes, which is quite a new aspect. But it all goes back to the fact that the people who've made their money today, they've made it themselves, and often they're younger as well, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. Younger people have different cultural references, and they do not necessarily admire the art of the West anymore.
Right. Yeah, that's another aspect that I feel like maybe that's different in China, because the owner of private museum are actually much younger than the owner of private museum here or in the States. You talk to I think Michael Xu, who was 20 when he founded the museum, and even his partner Amos, the other couple, they were really young in their mid-20s. Mm. Why do you think that's
extraordinary? It's because we have seen this enormous boom in making fortunes today as well. I mean, people can make money on the internet, you know, they create there, and they can become billionaires sometimes. Well, they're often in their 30s, a few are in their 20s, and they have this enormous amount of money. And what's quite interesting is that there are not that many trophies you can buy if you've got a huge amount of money. Art is probably one of the few things. In a previous book, somebody pointed out that Ferraris, you know, because there are limited editions, you have to wait for them, you have to be friends with the dealer to get on the list and so on. Jewelry, I suppose, diamonds, which also have, of course, the advantage of being very transportable, and that's an interesting aspect of art as well. It's transportable. But there aren't that many other things. If you've made a huge amount of money that you can spend your money on, and that gives you those bragging rights, these are trophy purchases. And of course, the ultimate trophy purchase was Leonardo da Vinci's Salvador Mundi, which sold for $450 million. Because there was only one in the world. Now, you can have a yacht made for you, and that will cost an enormous amount of money, but you can have it made, it's possible. It might take a few years. But you can't make a Leonardo.
I know you have mentioned this. Actually, I listened to all the interview you have done with other podcasts. And
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I sound like a broken record.
No. I just don't want to repeat what you have already said. Yes. But I still want to talk about the company museum and also the shopping mall museum.
In the West, there has been a sort of, they look down in a way on it, which is unfair, in fact, because the shopping mall museum can be a very good museum. Not all of them are very. Some of them are very uneven. Some of them are just something to bring people into the shopping mall. But you have to remember, it was quite interesting. I went to see a not a very good museum in Indonesia. But a person who owned it said to me, but people don't have that many places to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a shopping mall is somewhere that I used to go to. It's safe, it's clean, it's air-conditioned. You know, so it's sort of normal in a way to put a museum in there, to be part of the cultural offer.
Yeah, and you are one of the rare one, I have to say, that actually has been quite positive, all those shopping mall museums. Even now, like in China, I think people are more and more criticized on the, you know, either K11 or, you know, other.
Have you been to K11?
Yes.
It's pretty terrible.
I have been to see some good show, not the one in Shanghai, the one in Hong Kong.
The Shanghai one.
Yeah,
I've seen some pretty bad shows there. But then apparently there are some I missed are so good.
Yeah.
Are good. I don't have a great objection. I think if you bring art to the people, that's good. If the museum is, you know, has a proper curator, if they have a proper program, if they have an outreach program, if they bring children in, why not? I don't think one should be too negative, but it stands on the quality of the exhibitions it goes. If they're, I mean, K11 in Shanghai, they did have a show of, was it Monet?
And yes,
that's right.
That broke the record.
Yes.
Yeah.
But there weren't that many Monets in it, as I remember.
No.
And they weren't very good quality. No. So that is the thing. I'm not necessarily opposed to the shopping mall museum.
Right.
I mean, I think we have to democratize art. It should be for everyone.
Yeah. What about corporate museums?
Well, this is a really interesting aspect because there's a quote in the book which is so interesting. When somebody said to me, the thing about the luxury goods companies is that their museums have got to be also wonderful because they are promoting the brand. Mm-hmm. But the same person said to me, it's enabled me to see paintings from Russia. I'm talking about the Louis Vuitton Museum, beautiful architectural project. It's enabled me to see pictures that I wouldn't have been able to see, or it would have been complicated to go to Russia, to go to two different towns with the visas and so on. So to an extent, you could say, well, they do fulfill a need. They enable an extremely rich man to show his trophies, which is better than him keeping them in his home. Mm-hmm. So I think that you can really, in a way, argue both ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm not opposed either to them. Yeah. I think slight problem is that they tend to be quite expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I obviously know about the Pinault Museums, mm-hmm. and there's quite this amusing fight, in a way, between these two luxury goods moguls,
yeah.
François Pinault and Bernard Arnault. It's not public, but it seems there's a lot of competition between mm-hmm. them. And I mean, Pinault, he's now got three museums.
Yes,
he's
yeah.
got the Bourse du Commerce. Mr. Pinault is a genuine lover of art. I think he's genuinely interested. I don't think Mr. Arnault is. Mm-hmm. Arnault is, if it's interested in culture, it's more music. His wife is a musician. You know, perhaps look at the bottom line is that Paris has now got these two amazing museums.
Yeah.
They're going to have soon, in 2 or 3 years' time, they're going to have the Fondation Cartier,
mm-hmm.
another luxury goods, which is going to have a beautiful new museum right beside the Louvre. So why should we criticize it just because a rich person does it?
Yeah, and you actually mentioned that Pinault's third museum in Paris, actually he said he's not taking advantage of any
of the tax breaks.
Yeah,
no, but I think he gets other tax breaks, but he hasn't taken advantage of those tax breaks.
Yeah, so in terms of tax, can you...
Well, now this is a really interesting because a lot of people have said to me, yes, these private museums, they're just tax breaks for billionaires. And that's actually not true, except in America, where there is in the American tax code, there's something called the 501c3 category, which is a private foundation. And I think there have definitely been abuses. And in fact, there was a report that spoke particularly of 11. These private museums were inaccessible, badly advertised, not often open, and yet the owners were claiming complete tax write-offs, which doesn't mean that they weren't spending money on the museum, because they were, because the tax write-off is never as much as you invest, obviously. And this, you can really argue, is a problem, because that tax money they haven't spent otherwise could have gone to a public project. Mm-hmm. This is a problem in America, to an extent in France, because they have this for companies, they have this tax break, not for private individuals. And the tax codes are not very sympathetic. China, I don't think there are any tax breaks at all. This is something that I think needs reforming in America. And curiously, there was this Senator Hatch report, which I write about. It hasn't been changed.
Right.
The tax codes haven't been changed. But I think it did shake up the people who have private museums, and that they are more mindful of giving a public service. It's got to be for the public benefit if they get a tax break.
Yeah, I remember in your last book, The Dark Side of the Boom, you actually talk about this quite extensively.
Yes.
And so, yeah, my question was, has it changed much? Because that book, it was in 2017.
It was 17, I wrote it.
Yeah.
It was published in 18. Well, as I say, I think it It hasn't changed as far as the tax codes are concerned. They haven't changed it. But I think that the owners of these museums are much more careful now to be more accessible, to have better outreach programs, to bring have educational programs. And so not really just to treat their museum as a tax write-off. Right. But there are abuses, there's no doubt. And there are abuses not only in America, where I think there's the worst abuses, but sometimes people will establish a foundation and they'll put everything, all the expenses into the foundation, except the art, and they keep the right to sell the art. That's not good either. They should be forced, if they make a private museum, they should be forced to put the art in as well, so that they can't just use it, I mean, to write off the heating, the chauffeurs, the people, everyone who works for them, but not the art.
Right. And what about the situation in the UK?
Well, the situation in the UK, there aren't that many private museums.
Right, yeah.
There's one I write about, there's one very nice art park.
Jupiter Art.
Yes, yeah. Jupiter Art, which is very nice, and they have a very good program for children. So that's good. And it's also good because it's a part of Edinburgh, which is not particularly touristy. So it's also had what they call the Bilbao effect. So producing a cultural attraction brings people to the area, and therefore people will spend money, they'll go to the cafes. And in fact, a good example of that is I was on holiday in France this summer, and there's a museum in a town called Lens. It's actually the Louvre, so it is a publicly funded museum, and they made an outpost, if you like, and they sent some works from the Louvre to Lens. Lens was an extremely run-down, old mining town, really needed some help. I went, I stayed the night, we had dinner in the restaurant, we had lunch. So we brought money to that area purely because of the museum.
Right.
So, and a private museum, I give the example in Hobart, in Australia,
yeah,
in
I have been to,
Tasmania.
Yeah. Mona.
Yeah, yeah, Mona, yes. I mean, that's had an incredible effect on Hobart, which was not somewhere people went before. So you can criticize them, but they do have positive benefits.
Why do you think there aren't that many like private museums in the UK?
I don't think the tax code is very helpful, but there also there's not that many collectors in the UK. If you think about it.
But we have the biggest, one of the biggest fairs.
It has a very big fair, and it's a very, it's one of the three big art markets, but that's because it's a trading hub, mm-hmm. and always has been. It has a lot of rich residents, but they're not necessarily opening, you know, constituting their collection. I think Brexit hasn't helped, because I think when it was part of Europe, it was probably... But traditionally, it's the language is English, which is for a lot of people who come from other countries is a facility. And its position between the two time zones has made, all of these have made the UK a good centre for trading art. But who are the major collectors? Charles Saatchi has given up, and his museum is now, quite frankly, his gallery, the Saatchi Gallery, is just a hire gallery. Which is a problem with Chinese galleries as well. A lot of them are hire galleries. Apart from Saatchi, who are the other big collectors?
No, can't think of.
You can't think of anyone, you see. There are no big collectors like Pino and Arno. There's no big collectors as you have in America, where you have lots and lots, Leon Black, you know, you have lots of major collectors. You also have major private museums like the one in Crystal Bridges, which belongs to the Waltons, which has infinite amount of money. The Getty has a colossal amount of money, and they just, in fact, bought this Caillebotte. They spent $50 million on one painting. That's something that a state museum really can't do.
And another question is about, do you think the pandemic has changed how, you know, private museum collects and how their program?
Well, interestingly, the pandemic has actually enriched people. It's increased the polarization between the rich and the poor. And the rich have got a lot richer. So I don't think the pandemic will have changed. And we still see more private museums on track to open up. Maybe the opening was put off a little bit, like as in China, but I think the one, for example, in Russia, that the pandemic might have slowed things down, the one that belongs to Leonid Mikkelsen that I visited in hard hat, you know, it was being rebuilt. It's enormous, absolutely enormous. He's got an enormous amount of money. So I don't think that the private museum has been that affected by the pandemic. I think the art market has, but that's a different subject.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And also in conclusion, that I found it very true at the moment, you said one of the biggest problems is how private museum owners shape the public sphere of art through financing and loans of works, and how, you know, their taste can set the cultural agenda, and how that, you know, can also enhance their value of collections.
I think this is a big problem. I think that this is also, and as a journalist, I have to say the media is a little bit to blame as well, because we only focus on the very top prices. And I think the danger is to think that a work that has sold for an enormous amount of money is the most significant work. And so if you're a billionaire and you can pay an enormous amount for a work of art, way back, at the beginning of this century, a Lauder, you know, that's Estee Lauder, Fortune, he paid an enormous amount for a Klimt, and he put it in his own private museum, which doesn't apparently have any public benefit. You pay to go in. And he said, oh, this is the Mona Lisa. Well, Klimt, it's a good picture. It's probably his best picture, but you cannot say that Klimt is the best artist in the whole world. Mm. So I think there is a danger, and I think this happens in China as well. I think that museums are used to enhance, if they're not selling spaces, which happens as well, but art can be used to enhance the value of somebody's holdings. And there's another thing that we haven't touched on, and I don't think I had time to touch on in the book, is that a lot of people borrow money against their collections. Mm-hmm. So they have, you know, a collection worth 100 million, they can borrow up to 50 million from their bank, and they can use that money either to buy more art or invest in another business and so on. And so owners have got an interest in keeping the value of their holdings high because they've borrowed against it. They do not want the price of art to go down, because then there would be a reevaluation of the value of their collection, and those loans might have to be adjusted. So unfortunately, there is, there is an impetus for very rich owners to keep the prices high.
Yeah. Well, is there any way that, you know, the situation can change? Because I don't know, in China, like most of the private museum owner has that kind of agenda. And also that has very complex reasons. You know, there's no tax incentive, no government support, and they have to do that in order for their museum to be sustainable or to be opened.
Yes, I mean, I devote a whole chapter to the problem of the sustainability of these private museums, because I believe a lot of them will disappear when the founder disappears, because they've got the drive, they've got the vision, they've got the interest. Their successors may not necessarily have any of those things. And so I think these museums will disappear. Others will take their place. I think that longer term, we really need to have a long conversation about the public and the private spheres and how they work together. I think public-private partnerships are a really good idea. So somehow, you know, a long-term loan to a state-funded museum, that would be a good solution. And that we see a lot in Germany, for example. And then there was this attempt to somehow have something between LACMA and the Youth Museum in Shanghai, but they would never reply to my questions. So I don't think that was ever completed. That would have been a good solution. I don't think things are going to improve for publicly funded museums. They're not going to get more money from the state. They're going to have to raise more money themselves. So I think that we need really to do creative thinking about how these two entities can work together. And it should be possible, because private museums do bring a lot. You go to Paris, you know, I'm going to Paris next week. I'm going to go and see the Morozov collection. Well, that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And also in the interview you have done with our newspaper, I think Ben Luke mentioned that, you know, audience doesn't really know the difference between public institute and private.
No. And do they care?
Yeah, do they care?
As long as they're shown wonderful art in a beautiful building, it enhances their experience. But of course, there's the problem is that at the same time, the private museum owners can pay such huge prices that this is taking away from the public institutions. On the other hand, you know, until they arrived, the public institutions, you know, they were the most important. They were the ones who set all of the agendas, and now they have competition. So it's a very complex problem. It's not easy to say, this is a good solution, that's a good solution. I think we're still feeling our way. The other thing is that, of course, the public institution is under a lot of pressure at the moment. Sources of funding, for example, fossil fuel companies, so that's their sponsorship, looking at their collections and saying what they call decolonializing, that they have a lot of pictures that were perhaps left to them by people who were slave traders. Mm-hmm. They tend to be focused on dead white males from Europe. We need, those museums need to be much more diverse in their curation, in what they show, in their outreach programs. So I think all of this is shaking up the whole museum field, public and private.
Okay. Okay, I think my very last question.
Yes.
What's your next project?
Well, I have another book. I'm working on another. I'm just starting to work on another book, which will, I think, go look at the impact of the pandemic on probably more on the art market. So I'll leave the museum field. Yes, all the impact, and particularly on technology, and particularly on NFTs, which is the big hot topic at the moment.
So do you think there will be like NFT, well, there are already like a crypto NFT art museums that
yes.
existing in digital worlds.
Yes, yes. And the whole metaverse is really interesting. I think that NFTs at the moment, the art ones, because there's NFTs for lots of things, not just art, but the art ones, people particularly, I think they're ridiculously overvalued. Mm-hmm. And I think that is very linked to cryptocurrency and the booming crypto. And you can't easily spend cryptocurrencies. So I think that there's been a push by people who own cryptocurrencies to push up NFTs. But I think NFTs are an answer to a problem in the digital world of ownership and of authenticity. So I think they do absolutely have a future, but I think they're overvalued at the moment.
Right. So when is that book going to come out?
Well, I mean, it won't be for a couple of years, I wouldn't have thought. It takes a long time to write a book.
Yeah.
First you have to write it, and then you have to check it, and then somebody else has to check it.
Yeah.
So it's a long process, and you have to print it and publish it. So I think... I was hoping next year, but maybe.
It seems like especially the NFT, the crypto world kind of changes on a daily basis.
Absolutely. So, yes, and that would be good to put a bit of time and to see.
Yeah.
Of course, any book that I write, which is about what's happening in the world today, is out of date by the time it's printed. But you can't get around that one.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.